KPCW News Time is 8:06. You're listening to the local news hour. Let's find out what's in store for our weather this weekend. On the phone, I've got Cedric Haynes with ABC4. Good morning, Cedric.
Good morning. Hope all is well this morning as we're kicking off the day. They're on the chilly side with those temperatures in the 20s. But overall, as we go throughout the day, not too bad. As we look at your forecast here for today in the Heber Valley, we're looking at a chance of a couple of isolated rain or snow showers developing this afternoon, specifically after about lunchtime. And we could see even just a little bit of rain mixed in with that, as well as temperatures are going to warm up into the mid-40s there in the Heber Valley as we go throughout the day. Little or no snow accumulation expected with this activity. Now in Park City, we're looking at partly cloudy skies and a chance of a few more of those pop-up showers and developing, mainly in the form of a few snow showers there. We'll put the chance at about 40 to 50%, so not a complete washout by any means, but there will likely be a few flakes that will start to develop again as we get into the afternoon hours with some daytime heating. High temperatures there in Park City will likely climb to about 40 degrees for a daytime high. Now so going into the weekend, we've got some beautiful weather heading your way. We're looking at lots of sunshine for both your Saturday and for your Sunday. We kick off our Saturday morning with temperatures around 20 degrees to kick off the day in both Park City and in the Heber Valley. And as we go throughout the afternoon, we'll look at those high temperatures climbing into the low to mid 40s there in Park City. We'll see those highs climbing into the low 50s in the Heber Valley. And then on Sunday, we've got plenty of sunshine with mid 20s to kick off our day. But I'll tell you, that sunshine is going to do numbers for our temperatures. So by the time we get towards your Sunday afternoon, even though it starts off on a cold note, we'll see those highs climbing to near 50 by your Sunday afternoon in Park City. And high temperatures will be in the mid to upper 50s in the Heber Valley. And then as we move into next week, well, it's going to finally start feeling and looking like spring around here. We'll call it mostly sunny skies in Park City for us on our Monday. Temperatures starting off around 30 degrees with highs rebounding all the way back up close to 60 degrees in Park City by the time we get towards our Monday afternoon. In the Heber Valley, we're looking at a mixture of clouds and some sunshine out there. Temperatures, again, starting off in the upper 20s to near 30, but we rebound into the mid to upper 60s for the afternoon hours in the Heber Valley, and we'll call it partly sunny skies by the afternoon. Now, a weak front will try to make its way and kind of clip the northern half of the state as we go into your Monday night into Tuesday. And that'll give us, again, a few more of those clouds as we go into that time frame. That'll help hold temperatures up, only dropping down into the mid-30s for both Park City and the Heber Valley. And I guess we can't rule out an isolated sprinkle or a spotty shower as that front moves through. But for the most part, it's looking dry with just a few clouds on the increase for us by that time frame. And after that front moves through, instead of cooling things down, we're going to continue the warming trend as we'll see highs as by the time we get towards next Wednesday back in the low 60s in Park City. How about highs right around 70 in the Heber Valley? And by the time we get towards Thursday, it gets even warmer, folks. So we're talking high temperatures in the upper 60s in Park City and high temperatures in the mid 70s in the Heber Valley. So if you're hoping for more spring-like weather conditions, looks like we've got that in the forecast for you. A perfect week next week for that.
All right, Cedric, thanks much, and have a good weekend.
You too. Thank you.
And let's see what these rapidly changing temperatures are going to do in the Bank Country. On here with a report is Greg from the Utah Avalanche Center.
Yeah, good morning. We certainly do have some warm weather heading our way, and you just heard Cedric talking about the sunshine that's going to be in full force by this weekend. But if we just look back over this past week, particularly beginning Tuesday on April 1st, we've had 2 to 3 feet of snow in the Salt Lake and Park City Mountains. Yesterday afternoon, in about a three-hour period, Upper Little Cottonwood Canyon got 10 inches of snow. So huge amount of snow in a short period of time. There was some natural avalanche cycle that occurred around 2, 3 p.m. yesterday afternoon. People in the backcountry reporting some shallow soft slabs and long-running sloughs. I think the new snow instability should rapidly settle out. That happens when you have these quick overload of snow. It's reactive at the time, but it settles out pretty quickly. So today we're going with a moderate avalanche danger at the upper elevations and a low avalanche danger at the low and mid elevations. But I do think that some avalanche activity is possible. And I think it could involve two types. So one is going to be dry snow. And I think it's possible you can encounter some sloughing and shallow soft slabs of new snow. This is going to be dry snow. Also some recent wind drifts. This is primarily going to be in steeper terrain. But also, the big uncertainty for me today is wet snow. Mm-hmm. We're not expecting strong sunshine. We do have some partly cloudy skies this morning, but we may have more clouds this afternoon. The thing is, at this time of the year, that sun is strong, so you definitely want to watch out for rapidly changing conditions with warm snow today. Even if the sun doesn't come out in force, I think that there could be some cloud cover which retains heat. So we call this greenhousing, and it can rapidly change the snow surface. So for me, that's the big unknown today, is the effect of warming. So watch for rapid changes to the snow during any period of warming. And if so, you'll notice a it'll quickly lead to a rise in avalanche danger. And then lastly, you know, I think we've had a lot of snow. I'm expecting some people are going to get into some big terrain today and tomorrow morning. And these are appropriate conditions for mm-hmm. doing that. You know, we have a lot of snow, generally stable snowpack. So, yeah, I think if someone's looking for some big objectives, big terrain, it's a good time to do that. But you want to be careful when you enter that terrain. Watch for parties below you and only expose one rider at a time on the slope. So one more day of unsettled weather, and then, yeah, full-on spring next week.
All right, Greg. Thanks, and have a good weekend.
You as well. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Coming up, we're going to be speaking with Terry Orr about how the Sundance Film Festival evolved over the many years it has been in Park City. Then I'll speak with Andy Hecht, the Climate Fund Manager at the Park City Community Foundation, and we'll finish our hour by speaking with Brandy Strand of Preservation Utah about the Most Endangered Historic Places list. Stay tuned. You know, last Friday, I had the chance to speak with Jennifer Wesselhoff. That was sort of the day after the Sundance announcement. We got to talk about the economic impact of the departure of the Sundance Festival. You know, we got a lot of feedback about that interview, as a lot of people shared sort of the, almost coping with the quasi-emotional aspect of the departure of the festival and what that means to the community. I sort of thought it would be nice to follow that up by talking a little bit about sort of the way that the festival was intertwined with this community, a little bit about the history and how it evolved with the community over the many years it's been here. Terry Orr joins me in the studio this morning. Terry, talk to us a little bit about your history. I know it goes back a long way with Sundance.
Well, it does, and we I think talking about this in an emotional way is completely fair, because the festival grew up with a lot of us growing up with it. It started out through the Utah Film Commission, and it was in Salt Lake City and some funky town in the middle of nowhere, Utah, just for fun. And then it went into Salt Lake a little more, and then it was flailing. And that's where we get to Redford and all the rest of it. But I started working with the Utah Film Commission in a press capacity and with the festival. And
now, before it was even up here?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And then as it moved here, it made more sense. So another woman and I had a little PR company, and we did some work with them. And it was great fun. We went down to a place in Hollywood called the Rose Tattoo, which was a really sleazy, wonderful place to have a press conference, you know, pop-up thing, and to encourage people to come to Utah and come to the festival. As it was falling apart is when Redford stepped in and said he would rescue it. And reluctantly, because he very much wanted to keep Sundance Resort private. It had become this retreat center for he and his film buddies. And he would have camps there every summer for rotating every 2 weeks plus. And, you know, Spielberg and all those guys would go down there and they would talk about the art of making movies and how it was changing and storytelling, and that was Bob's thing. He wanted to have better stories told.
And of course, I have a recollection of walking down Main Street and seeing this sign on the Egyptian called U.S. Film Festival. So were the first showing, when does that come to Park City, and how long was it sort of called the U.S. Film Festival?
You know, I don't know the exact number of years, but it was in 1981 that I was involved in mm-hmm. rehabbing the Egyptian Theater. And so we were able to convince them that that was a great space. And of course, Redford loved it because it was intimate. And he was someone who loved Park City. He would come over and have lunch at Cafe Torrego and take the same table in the back so that he wasn't sitting in the front. And he loved it here. And he thought, well, better to mess up Park City than to mess up Sundance, I think. So he was outside the theater. You know, this story's been retold multiple times, but it's actually true, hawking tickets because no one wanted to come watch an unknown documentary or an unknown film. And with his cachet, people would buy the ticket and come in and take a chance.
So at the beginning, was it really just that one theater?
It was, and then it went to the Holiday Village Cinemas, then popped up, and so we were able to use that space as well. The Holiday Inn, which is now the DoubleTree, that was a great place, and it had the tiniest, funkiest little bar I was thinking about after Melvin and Howard debuted, which was about Howard Hughes and the gas station attendant who said that he had left everything to him. Jonathan Demme had put together that film. And we watched the premiere over at the Holiday Village Cinemas, and then we walked into the bar, and it was, Rick Bruff was there, and I don't remember who else, but there were maybe six of us with Jonathan Demme while he was explaining how the film came about.
During the 1997 festival, I was working for the Park Record, and I did an interview with Dennis Leary in that bar at midnight, and it was just one of those exceptional experiences, you know. There was a lot that went on at that bar during those
There was
years.
A lot that went on at that bar, and then the morning after place was the Mount Air Cafe. And I remember walking in one morning, and at opposite ends of those, you know, stools that used to be at the counter was Kevin Bacon and William Macy. And they were both ordering what we used to call vitamin G. So all the grease you could eat, you know, from the night before.
Okay, so it slowly spreads. We start with the Egyptian, then the Holiday Village. The Jewel becomes the Eccles Theater at the high school. And then when does that come along?
Well, it opened in 1998, and as we were building the joint use facility, again, Sundance was looking to move, and Spence Eccles had the foresight to say, he had already made one donation, but it became clear that the main floor of what was being proposed was not enough for the growth of the student body and the community. So he offered $1 million if we would put in the balcony. And so we built the balcony, and that added to it.
Talk about how that came together. I mean, because obviously it's, you know, Sundance is leaving. We're going to get to keep that theater, fortunately. How did that construction project, that whole vision, come together? And I know you were in the middle of it, weren't you?
Yeah, I was in charge of it. So yeah, that
and
was.
And that puts you in the middle, Terry.
That was more than the middle. And you know, tap dancing with the school board is always a fun thing to do. It's kind of a time-honored dance in Park City. And we wanted to make certain that we had a facility that worked well for the students to be able to, they were winning awards all over the state, drama awards, music awards, all of those things, but they were performing in what we called the cafeteria.
The cafeterium.
Cafeterium, yeah. And it was horrible, and my daughter was one of them, you know, so I was motivated to make sure that we had a better facility. And when we opened it, we wanted to do some things that were creative to the building. And the tension between the nonprofit and the school district was reaching a peak. So they said no. But one of the things was on your way into the Eccles Center, there are those ramps and steps, and they have rails that have rails between them. So kind of like a musical staff. So John Helton, who had been my cartoonist at the Park Record when I was editor there, he said, what if we did like these glass resin, they wouldn't break, balls, and it would be a song, and we would put these musical circles together? And the school district said, like, no and hell no. So that went away. So then we said, what else can we do? And then I said, well, we need a podium. You know, we need some place for people to put their papers when they're on stage or whatever. So he took this cello and reimagined it and created that beautiful, beautiful podium that we have. And it was, it's wood, and he used wood glue. And he said, it's not exactly dry the night of the opening of Sundance. And I said, okay, that's fine. And he said, so just don't let anybody lean on it. I said, okay. So, you know, people weren't used to a podium. It was a nice addition. And sure enough, you know, within the first 3 days, the person who leaned on it was Michael Moore, who was a person of some substance.
Yes, a substantial filmmaker.
But by then the glue was dry. So
Okay, so this dance, I mean, you got $1 million from Spence Eccles. I assume some came from the school system, some came from the Institute. How did you
do it? A bond election. Yeah. It was you know, the old-fashioned form of nonprofit fundraising. You're begging. Okay. You're begging your friends. You're offering them plaques on seats in the wall in the front that has names etched in.
Okay, so you mentioned before, Sundance was talking about leaving at that point already?
Yeah.
And how important was it, was this facility?
It was critical. It was absolutely critical. I mean, yeah. We added 1,200 seats to the town. And five times a day, it's, you know, a lot of moviegoers.
And again, so now we have the Holiday Village, we have the Eccles, and over time they start to expand to these other venues. Again, how did that start to change the way the festival felt?
You know, it felt organic at the time. Mm-hmm. It felt like we were just grateful for the other spaces. Where we had the party, there was one big party at the end of the festival, and it was in the Racquet Club. And the Park City Rotary Club would go in and put down a fake floor. And then we got weather balloons from the Salt Lake Weather Station so we could fill up the room, because there certainly weren't going to be enough people to go to the party, so we wanted it to look full.
That's where the tennis courts are, right?
Yeah, where the tennis courts.
Yeah, it had, you know, for a big Hollywood, you know, film-related thing, it also had some sense of a feeling of a high school prom. They decorated the gym, right?
We literally did. The building that is now the Marquee was the memorial building, and it had a gym in it at the time. And when Hoop Dreams won, they decided that there are still, you know, 40-something women with their cheerleading outfits packed away, that they should wear those, and we should decorate the basketball hoops and have the after party honor that film.
The Steve James film. Went to high school with Steve James, and I was the manager of the basketball team that he played on.
Wow. Wow.
There's a piece of
arcane.
There's
some street cred.
There's some arcane trivia. Okay, so there was an organic sense of the festival, and I felt that the community felt very involved with it, certainly in many of those years, you know, again, going into the beginning of this century. How did it change? It seemed to me that the relationship between the festival and the community evolved.
Well, it did, because the festival in the beginning of time here in Park City was in the fall, and that was a great time. And as skiing was changing and the amount of people coming, what we found out as a community is that, you know, Christmas was great, and then we sat around until President's Weekend or maybe even Easter, depending on the snow. So the community asked Sundance to move.
That's interesting.
Into January, and they did. They said, sure, this is as good as any. And that was a good move. It was a good move for Sundance. It was a good move for the community. And, you know, you can talk to any number of longtime restaurants. I think of Cafe Torrego, and who was, you know, a lot of folks don't know there's an upstairs to Cafe Torrego, and so that was where someone like Harvey Weinstein would throw his parties. And there are numerous stories you could have there.
You can't leave us hanging.
That's it.
That's all we're going to get?
That's all you're going to get.
Okay. Interesting that partying with Harvey Weinstein sort of has a different sort of cachet now than
Cafe
it did at
Cafe Torrego,
the time.
You know, it's all relative. You're sitting there having dinner.
Okay.
He came into the Eccles, actually, to see a premiere when I was in the lobby, and he had his big fat cigar with him. And he was smoking it, and I went outside and I said, welcome to the Eccles Center. We're so glad that you're here, Mr. Weinstein, and you're on school property in Utah, and there's no smoking allowed. And he said, I'm not putting out my cigar, and that film is premiering. And I said, I'm so sorry, but we can't have you come in with the cigar. So we went back and forth for a little bit, and he finally took his cigar and he rubbed it in the railing of the Eccles Center and stuck it in his pocket.
Fabulous image of Terry Orr and Harvey Weinstein going at it.
That sentence you don't want to use again.
Okay. But the relationship did change. And, you know, I, over time, I at least heard some locals saying, you know, we're a little tired of the way they treat us. What was your perspective? I mean, was that fair on the community's part? And why do you think people started to say things like that?
Oh, I don't know. You know, I think we get spoiled. I think those of us that have been here a long time really appreciate when there is an event that helps the community. Do we have events that come around and maybe don't help the community? Sure. But Sundance wasn't one of them. And so I always had a great relationship. And it was, you know, at the Yuccel Center, it was complicated. It was a circus every single day of the festival.
Yeah.
And the first year of the festival, I remember going out to the lobby. We were very nervous about every, you know, the sound, the lights, everything working. And we had those walkie-talkies, you know. So with the walkie-talkie, I went into the hallway and I said to the person who was handling the talent with Sundance, you better come into the lobby right now. Because who was in the Big Lebowski?
Jeff Bridges.
I said, Jeff Bridges has just come out of the men's room with slippers and a bathrobe on, and his hair is all askew, and he's just a mess. And the person on the other end said, he's in character, Terry. And it was the Big Lebowski that...
Yeah. I did not recall that the Big Lebowski premiered at Sundance. Wow. Okay, how important has the festival been in enhancing this city's image as a center for arts and culture?
Huge.
Yeah.
You really can't quantitate that in terms of all the press that we got for years. I was still freelancing in the beginning. I wrote stories for The Hollywood Reporter, for Daily Variety, for InStyle magazine. And getting out the word that Park City was on the map, even if you didn't make it to the festival, then it piqued your curiosity. Maybe I will go there skiing, and maybe still I'll go there in the summer and check it out.
It's a big hole, Harry. A big hole, Terry, that it's going to leave in our community. How do you think we're going to fill it?
Oh, please. You think I'm the one who has the answer
well,
to
you're
that?
Here.
I think, and I have felt this for a long time, that Park City either embraces arts and culture or walks away from it, because it does a very seesaw dance. And whether that's the Kimball Arts Center, whether that's the Yuccel Center, whether that's the Egyptian, whether that's the library, it doesn't matter what the venue is, so much as it matters that the city embrace that. And the chamber, since Jennifer has come, has been absolutely doing a great job of embracing it. But prior to that, the only things the chamber was in is if it had a bat, a ball, or a stick.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It wasn't, the arts were not embraced.
All right, Terry, last question before we go. You've told us some fun stories. Give us your favorite Sundance memory.
Oh,
I know it's like one of your children.
It's Sophie's Choice.
Give us a favorite Sundance memory.
Well, I think
memory.
I did. Okay. I think I was giving you some of them.
Right.
I remember when we did U2 in 3D that premiered at the Yuccel Center. They came in a month before because the 3D was so important to them that they get it right. And Bono's manager, this is wee little Irishman, came and he spent the month with us. We were able to get the 3D glasses, 100 pair, for 100 high school kids to be the first in the planet to see U2 in 3D as it was being tested. And so that premiere night was going to be great. Bono's folks wanted to make sure it was great. So they were going to come in after the last film ended the night before to test the equipment. Mm-hmm. And so Sarah Pierce, who was the assistant director then, was there in the theater with me, and, you know, we all had our radios. The Egyptian theater's projector blew up, and there was a fire at the Egyptian. And so Sarah was trying to figure out if she should go there or stay and wait for the tech people to come for U2. So she stayed, and that was when the lovely Latinx people who were cleaning decided they were going to clean the lobby. And I wish I spoke another language, but I do not. And so I was apparently making motions like I was mopping and trying to get them to stop when the crew from U2 walked in. And the first part. And then the doors shut and Sarah was laughing hysterically. And I said, what's the matter? I said, they're going to come any minute. She goes, no, that was Bono and the band. They all came together. You nearly wiped out the whole band with your... So...
Okay. Terry Orr, thanks for spending time with us this morning looking back at Sundance. It's going to be missed, isn't it?
It is.
All right. We'll be right back after this. Well, Summit County is committed to eliminating food waste from the landfill by 2030. Here to talk about why and a new pilot program to divert food waste is Andy Hecht. He's the Climate Fund Manager at the Park City Community Foundation. Good morning, Andy, and thanks for being here.
Oh, good morning. Thank you so much for having me on.
Andy, as you were walking in, I learned for the first time that you worked for Sundance for a number of years. We probably should have had you in for that last interview.
I was listening intently. Terry shared so much information and wisdom, and I just love it. Yep.
All right. When we get to the end of this, I'm going to ask for your favorite Sundance story, but that's not what we're here to talk about. What's the big deal? Why should our listeners care about food waste?
Oh, boy, that's the question. I got to start with saying you said it on the intro. Summit County is all in on this. This is amazing. We are supported by so many different people, nonprofits, restaurants, and the community is embracing this. It makes sense economically. It saves tons and tons of money over the long run with the landfill. It also is incredibly valuable for the climate.
And I want to talk a little bit more about that. I mean, it's common sense to me. I can understand why food waste takes up space over at the 3 Mile facility. By definition, we're running out of space like every other landfill. But, you know, I think of food waste as it's natural. It's going to, you know, decompose. Why? Well, what's wrong with having it in the landfill? Well, what's the climate implications of this?
Well, decomposition comes in many different forms. When the food gets to the landfill, it goes through something a little bit more colloquial as rotting.
Okay.
And the rotting is not, you got to think of the landfill. It's a huge toxic environment. Nothing that goes to the landfill will really ever be repurposed. Food waste going into the landfill is never going to turn into a soil. What it does is it rots. Mm-hmm. But the big issue that we are understanding more and more and more of is while this food rots, it's creating massive amounts of methane. Methane is just really bad. I mean, I can give you statistics. 25 times worse than CO2, more potent. Over 100 years, we talk about significantly more potency of methane in greenhouse effect.
Okay, so we got a problem. And, of course, lots of people have this problem, but we're going to try to address it here.
There's a lot of solutions with that.
Let's talk about solutions. What is the Zero Food Waste Initiative?
Yeah, the Zero Food Waste Initiative is a program from Park City Community Foundation, which Park City Community Foundation focuses on the largest challenges across our community. Well, a couple years ago, we said we have this amazing climate fund. What can we do? What issue in our community is there for us to solve? And food waste. All the experts came back and they said, look at what you're doing with your food waste. You generate a lot of organic waste in a visitor, tourist-based economy town. There's a lot of food waste going to the landfill. Roughly half of what's getting to the landfill are organics. So we saw that as an opportunity. And we launched last year with residential, hitting residential really hard, asking people to sign up. We're still asking people to sign up, please. Go to Momentum Recycling and sign up. You can get tons of information at parkcitycf.org/zero food waste.
All right, let's stop with that for just a second. Okay, if I sign up for that, what happens to my food waste?
So right now, Momentum is the hauler. They will come to your house once a week, pick up food waste. They provide you
a separate container.
Yeah, they will provide you two different containers. One. Let me dispel one mystery here,
okay.
Or misconception. It is clean and it is easy. So they give you a bin, fits neatly under my sink. You can put it where you want to. It's clean. It comes with compostable bags. Just all your food waste, everything, chicken bones, anything that you could have eaten.
I
or
don't have
like
to
that.
Sort it other than, no. Basically I can scrape my plate at the end of the night and okay.
Yep, scrape everything, anything that comes off your cutting boards, anything that was once cooked. And then take that bag out, and they'll give you a bin. Most homes choose to go with a 5-gallon bin. Take the bag that's tied up, put it in the 5-gallon bin. Once a week, Momentum will come around. You've probably seen them driving around our community, pick that up, put it in the back of their truck, and they take it over to 3 Mile Canyon.
It's going back to that same 3 Mile place. Why is this better?
Oh,
what do they do with it?
I'm sorry. It's going to Browns Canyon.
Okay.
Oh, that was my mistake. It's not going to the landfill. It's going to a local composting facility right now.
So basically, there's a giant composting facility?
Yeah, yep. And there are
tours.
They
create soil?
It's amazing. And I don't want to get too far into that because I'm here to talk about this pilot program, but I do want to just put out there, we have some really major news coming out in about 2 to 2.5 weeks.
Oh,
about
a tease. Oh, yes. He's big doing a tease. He's going to want to come back.
Okay. I want to come back.
Okay. But let's talk about the initiative, because that is why one of the reasons we scheduled it here today. Although I did want to make sure that we might remind the community about the sort of curbside and how easy it is, because, you know, I think it's important.
And how much of a real issue food waste is. It's not something to take lightly. It's something achievable. It's something we can solve this problem, and it's easy. It's not expensive. In fact, it pays for itself.
I was going to say, and unlike many climate and environmental sort of issues that we can try to address, this one we can see linearly. If we do this, we're going to save the county a lot of money in terms of the landfill.
Absolutely. I mean, it's linear, absolutely. Right? If you go to our website, you can see how much money we have saved already from some estimates with EPA and working with the county. And
okay, pilot program. What are you up to?
Yeah, so we have just launched what we call the Zero Food Waste Restaurant Cohort. And what that is we're looking for 20 restaurants to join this cohort free of charge. They will have a one-day workshop with an organization called ReFed, and then they'll have 5 to 7 hours of consulting work afterwards. And we will also help them, we'll finance all of the startup costs to divert food waste. They're going to see tons of benefits from the workshop in terms of upstream battling waste, and it's just going to be a great program for 20 restaurants.
Do you have a vision of how, I mean, you know, I'm looking across the street at a restaurant. Do you have a vision of how mechanically the restaurants will be able to channel their food waste into a recycling stream? Have you gone through spent enough time with the program to understand it?
Well, here's the challenge of it, and this is really why we're doing this exact pilot, is every restaurant is different.
Right.
You know, a restaurant on Main Street looks very different than a restaurant in Prospector, which looks very different from a restaurant out in Kimball, or on the east side of Summit County. This is Summit County-wide. This isn't just Park City. But even between restaurants here on Main Street, they run and operate differently. So it's very individualized. And that's why we have the consulting hours. That's why we are entering this, is to learn from them so we can use what we've learned. What works at this restaurant? Okay, well, this restaurant's similar. We can institute that. So, okay, 20 restaurants are coming together. We're going to share what's working, what's going well, and grow beyond that.
And I guess at the end of the day, I mean, from a very high-level perspective, we're going to end up with bags of food waste similar to what's going on with the curbside that's going to end up going to that same composting facility?
Yes, but it's important to note that a lot of this workshop and what ReFed brings to this equation is not just the effluent flow of all this waste that once was going to the landfill. There are the technical aspects of running restaurants in terms of ordering, inventory control, menu planning, looking at things like maybe offering a smaller portion for a different price, maybe offering a different meal that utilizes other leftover food in the kitchen.
So you're going way beyond sort of just that mechanical, assuming a status quo of output. You're trying to manage food waste throughout the whole process.
Yeah.
We're trying to help the restaurants do that. I mean, yeah.
And you know, again, there's the two stories of one is there's a climate impact. Mm-hmm. But for restaurants, when they're using these resources that they'll be gaining from ReFed, they're going to see payback. They're going to see money in their pocket through all these technical aspects. And I'm not a restaurant person, so I can't really say what all these technicalities are. I'll be learning with this cohort. But there is some real savings to be had.
Okay, so if we've got restaurateurs listening today, what should they do if they're interested in finding out more and possibly signing up?
Yeah, absolutely. Number one is we have, I can't show a QR code on the radio.
Nah, it's really hard.
The best thing to do is to go to our website, parkcitycf.org.
Okay.
And I also want
to... And then when I get there, that's a big splash page. Will I be able to find your... How do I find your corner of the website?
That's a great question. I'm going to work with my marketing
to make sure. We'll post something. If you give us something, we'll post something on our website to make it easy for them to find this. So we'll post the full link. So.
Perfect.
Okay.
I also want to make it very clear, this is a really neat collaborative program through the Park City Chamber and Visitors Bureau and Park City Community Foundation.
Okay. Annie, anything else you want to add before we go? Any ways to add to the stream here?
No, I'm really thrilled by how much support we have from the community for this initiative. And for those of you who have not signed up yet, please sign up. Realize how easy this is. And once you start diverting your food waste, you'll realize how little trash you actually have coming out of your house. Recycling, organics, and then there's a little leftover that's trash.
All right. Andy Hecht of the Park City Community Foundation, thanks for being here this morning.
Thank you so much.
We'll be right back after this. Well, Summit County is planning to lobby for changes to a bill that districts the county council. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports the governor has promised a special session to review the law.
House Bill 356 requires five new districts to elect the five Summit County Council members rather than the current system where every member is elected at large. Governor Spencer Cox recently said he agrees with the bill's intent but is calling for a special session to address, quote, unintended consequences.
Our legislative group is working to put forth new language addressing our unintended consequences that hopefully could be fixed during the interim session.
That's the announcement Summit County Council Chair Tanya Hansen made Wednesday. The Summit County government's three main asks are, one, reduce the number of districts to preserve one or two at-large seats, two, redesign the committee that draws districts to represent unincorporated Summit County, and three, don't assign current council members to districts at random.
Perhaps our county clerk could assign based on the district map and based on where we live, so it's not so arbitrary.
And there might be bipartisan agreement on all three points. Tori Welch, a Hoytsville Republican who lost a bid for council last November, tells KPCW his preference is keeping one at-large seat. Ari Ioannidis, a Republican in Tollgate who also lost in November, says he would support either a fully districted council or the original version of HB 356, which requires districts for 65% of council seats. After HB 356 changed to 100% districted, it affected other county governments. Wasatch County asked the governor for a veto, and although he signed the bill, Cox promised a special session for changes. On the second point, Welch is in favor of adding a Snyderville Basin representative to the committee that will draw the districts. Current council members worry the committee, made up of mostly the county's mayors, does not represent unincorporated residents. According to County and Economic Development Director Jeff Jones, two-thirds of Summit County lives on unincorporated land. About 12,000 of the almost 43,000 people live on the east side. The future districts will need to be proportionate according to population. And once the districts are drawn, House Bill 356 says the current council members serve out the remainder of their terms assigned to districts at random. Both Welch and Ioannidis agree with Hansen that assigning the current council to districts randomly doesn't make sense unless more than one council member resides in the same district. The debate over HB 356, which passed the Utah legislature mere minutes before the general session ended this year, has been about party, geography, and process. Deputy County Manager Jana Young rebuked it, saying it upended a 2006 voter decision switching from an at-large commission to council. But some Eastern Summit County residents say they're not well represented on the mostly west side and blue council. The rural side of the county tends to vote Republican. The Utah legislature didn't accept public comment on House Bill 356 this year. Ahead of the expected special session, Summit County is accepting public comment at the April 15th and 23rd council meetings. And Summit County's a financial supporter of KPCW. I'm Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
So I'm joined by phone with Brandy Strand, the Executive Director of Preservation Utah. Good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having us.
So, Brandy, let's talk a little bit about Preservation Utah. What is it, and how long has it been in existence?
Well, Preservation Utah has been around since 1966, and our entire mission is to preserve and protect our historic built environment and the cultural resources that connect us and provide anchors in our neighborhoods and identity and shared experience.
So is it both buildings and sort of other non-building landmarks?
Absolutely. Primarily, we do look at the historic built environment, but we also realize that neighborhoods have those historic pieces as well. So we also work within neighborhoods and cities to help preserve more of than just an individual building. We look at it as a whole picture.
And I know that you're seeking nominations for the 2025 Endangered Historic Places list, but before we sort of get to that specifically, you mentioned you've been around since the 60s. Is the primary sort of activity creating this list of historic places, or what else do you do?
Well, this is actually, our list is, this will be our second year doing it. So prior to that, we have been working with in cities and towns to collaborate with leadership and local residents to help them to preserve and protect their environment. But we also provide quite a bit of experiences. We believe that going into our historic spaces and having that become a tangible aspect for you helps everyone get more connected to our shared experiences as a humanity. So we do tours. We do programs, we do workshops, we do pretty much anything that will help someone save their spaces, but also help us get more connected to our past.
So that, and those are the kind of activities you've been doing for some time, I take it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, even our spring homes tour, we have one coming up on May 17th. That's going to be entirely in the avenues in downtown Salt Lake, where we're highlighting Richard Kledding's buildings that he has there. There's over 20 different homes in that neighborhood. So we try and really, like, get more involved in those local, unique pieces of our neighborhoods.
Okay. So you've mentioned that the list has been around for a couple of years. What made you want to do this, and how does it work?
That's a great question. Last year was actually our first time ever releasing our most endangered building list in Utah. And we realized that while we were out doing advocacy and we were working with local neighborhoods, this was an opportunity for us to put a bigger spotlight on these endangered spaces so that we could really hone in as a whole Utah community on what these spaces are and what they represent to local communities. This year, we've done our first ever outreach where we're asking for people to nominate what they find to be their most endangered spaces and buildings in their local communities. We want to hear from the community, and we want to hear about what's important to our neighbors so that we can then rally to support them in preserving and protecting that space or historic built environment.
So let's give our listeners a sense of what kinds of structures or locations ended up on the list last year.
Absolutely. So last year, we really tried to look at the state as a whole. So we highlighted the Logan Main Street. Mm. There's been a big loss of our historic built environment along Logan Main Street. We brought up in Salt Lake County, of course, Abravanel Hall in Japantown and everything that happened there. We look at schools. We highlighted the Fifth Ward Meeting House last year. And then we even got a little bit more broad and we looked at what are those larger impacts that are happening within neighborhoods. And that's where we started to realize that the historic districts in Salt Lake were also starting to see development pressures, and we were going to start to lose those historic built environments there. So we looked at the historic districts in Salt Lake, and then we took an even bigger look, and we said, what's happening on Salt Lake's west side? The east side of Salt Lake has a plethora of local historic districts that have really honed in on those special, unique aspects of those neighborhoods. We're not seeing that same level of protection on the west side. So we're really working to bring more awareness to the incredible history that we have on our west side. In fact, in October, we held our first ever historic homes tour in Rose Park. And it was absolutely amazing to not only go into the neighborhood and to celebrate it, but to hear from residents where their local pride came out and was able to share with us why it was so important that they don't want to lose their neighborhood.
So were there any buildings or locations in Summit or Wasatch counties that made the list last year?
Absolutely. We had highlighted the A-frames. So A-frames, there's a very small amount of A-frames still available of that ski era history. So we brought those to the forefront in Summit. We also highlighted the Byron T. Mitchell home. It's such a unique and beautiful structure, and it's just kind of sitting out there all on its own, and we wanted to make sure people knew about that building.
Where is that?
And then we the Byron T. Let me see. I'll pull up that address. Let's see. It's right along State Road 32 in France.
In Francis, okay.
Yeah. So, and then we also brought to the forefront the Thames Head Frame Building along with the Silver King Head Frame Building.
Right.
Because that roof was caved in. What's really cool is that the friends that are working on saving those pieces, they've actually been able to do some really good structural work on those buildings. And those were the three that we highlighted in Summit County.
And anything in Wasatch County?
No, not last year. But if anybody knows about what's happening in Wasatch County, let us know.
And what is the significance of being added to the list?
What I think it does is it brings a heightened level of awareness. A lot of times it's hard to save those historic pieces within our neighborhoods without the public's awareness and the community rallying around those places. I think a perfect example of this is what happened last year with the Bravenel Hall. It was just kind of, there was a big potential that we could lose it. And rather than just kind of sitting idly by and waiting for things to happen, the community, with the public awareness that was done around that building, rallied to secure that building's future. And that's what we're hoping that our endangered building list does, is that it highlights and hones in on those incredibly unique features within communities so that we can bring more public awareness to those pieces and then rally together as a community to save and protect those pieces.
And if someone wants to reach out to you to get something put on the list, how do they do that?
The best way to do that is to go to our website, www.preservationutah.org. You'll be able to find nomination information on our website, and we would love to hear about what's happening in your local neighborhood.
Okay. Anything else you want to add before we go?
No, just thank you so much for helping us to bring more awareness to this. I'm really excited about the opportunity to partner with communities and with individuals so that we can save and protect our history.
Okay. Thanks for spending time with us. We'll be right back after this. The Wasatch Immigration Project has hired an attorney to help locals navigate the immigration system. KPCW's Christine Weller reports it's in response to immigration crackdowns.
After taking office in January, President Donald Trump promised mass deportations of immigrants. Part of that effort included eliminating policies prohibiting arrests by U.S. immigration agents at or near sensitive areas. Those include schools, places of worship, healthcare facilities, shelters, relief centers, and public demonstrations like rallies and protests. Since its start in late 2023, the Wasatch Immigration Project has been working to build a legal community in Utah that values and supports immigrants. On the local news hour Monday, board member Enrique Sanchez said large deportation operations are occurring across the country.
It's typically being held in areas where either it's considered a sanctuary city or where there's a specific sector that is known to hire undocumented immigrants, so that, you know, is like farm workers and stuff like that.
In response to increases in deportations and U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement activity, the small nonprofit law firm has hired its first full-time attorney to help Wasatch-backed immigrants navigate the system. Laura Rojas was born and raised in Miami and worked as an assistant public defender in the city for over a decade. She moved to Park City about 10 years ago with her family, eventually joining the organization as a volunteer attorney. Rojas said she feels very lucky to join the staff in a paid, full-time position.
The work itself is, I think, a combination of intellectually stimulating and also fulfilling.
Rojas said her primary purpose is to meet with individuals from the Wasatch Back, look at their situation, and determine whether there's an option for them to move forward legally. She also wants to be a trusted resource, communicating with visitors in both English and Spanish.
Our real goal is to offer people the dignity of that conversation and provide honest legal advice. And that is what we're hoping to continue to do, because it's so stressful right now for individuals in our community.
The organization handles cases involving domestic violence, unaccompanied minors, labor or sex trafficking, crime victims, asylum seekers, and people under 21 who've been abused or abandoned. Rojas said work permits also go hand in hand with most applications. The firm has a waiting list of 100 people in need of assistance from its team of mostly volunteer attorneys. They say they're always looking for more attorneys willing to donate their time. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Park City Fire Chief Bob Zanetti is retiring. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports his replacement is a 20-year department veteran.
Deputy Chief Peter Emery has been tapped to lead the Park City Fire District effective May 1st. Zanetti tells KPCW Emery, his second in command, emerged as the obvious choice, and the Park City Fire Board Chair, Alex Pachwinski, agreed.
He's a product of our measuring system. And it became obvious after that he was the right guy.
Outgoing Chief Zanetti also emphasized the value of mentorship at Park City Fire. He and Emery have worked together for years.
When I started in Park City Fire in 2005, I was assigned to Station 35 under then Captain Bob Zanetti. as a firefighter.
Before that, he spent 5 years with South Davis Metro Fire Department. At Park City, Emery became an engine driver, captain, and then battalion chief. Zanetti says Emery impressed the late Chief Paul Hewitt as the training division's battalion chief.
Chief Hewitt came to me and goes, "Whoa, I've never seen anything quite like this." And I said, "Just sit back and let it happen, because he's going to make some changes around here." And he was in charge of the training at the time. And he just took off with things that we haven't seen, progression and new ideas.
After Hewitt passed away in 2021, Emery became Zanetti's deputy chief, and Emery says he's humbled to take up the mantle in May, adding he'll uphold Park City Fire standards and professionalism. Zanetti himself started at Park City Fire in 1989. He says it's been 36 years of fulfilling service.
It's been an incredible honor to serve as the fire chief for the community, and it's just been a dream come true. And I feel it's in great hands moving forward.
The Summit County Council approved Emery's appointment Wednesday with a starting salary of $208,000. Butwinski says that makes the chief the sixth highest paid statewide.
We think it's very competitive. It reflects what we think about him, but it's also not saying, okay, you deserve to be number one.
Emery hasn't chosen a new deputy chief. He doesn't expect the choice to be easy and says it will be a competitive process as well. As a note, Summit County is a financial supporter of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.